Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. Go to MUBI.com/filmstage and you can get 1 free month of the best streaming cinema the internet has to offer.
Digging it.
Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, as always, Brian J. Rowan. Joined with me today is Michael Snydell.
Hello. Brian, no matter how much we disagree about things, I always like your music choices.
Well, that is fantastic news.
Into it.
You can always start and end on an up note then. We also have... the very into it, Bill Graham.
Yeah.
And we are here today to talk about Camera Person, the film by director Kirsten Johnson. Yeah, that's it. Michael has been rubbing in our face some of the festival circuit films that he's been able to see, but as we are planning on having full reviews on those, we will not be allowing him to speak about any of them early.
Hush!
Suck it.
Just put me on blast, why don't you?
Damn right. Once again, our private Slack lives being broadcast for all of our listeners. So that is that. We can get into all the other stuff that we need to talk about before we talk about the film, such as where you can find us online. And that, of course, is on Twitter at Film Stage Show, on Facebook.com. You can search The Film Stage Show. And you can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And, of course, I always love to solicit a comment and a rating on iTunes, even though those are extremely rare, which makes me sad. Stop making me sad, listeners. Let's have just a little bit of rating and reviewing, shall we? That's I guess it. I always feel like these intros should be longer, and yet here we are, 2.5 minutes in, all done. But before we
I'm
do
at
get
four
into
and a half
review,
minutes, where are you at with this?
What?
I'm at 4.5 minutes.
That's how long this call has been, but we've only been recording. Well, now we've been recording for more like 3 minutes. Anyway,
we're behind the scenes.
Jesus Christ.
We've got 2 shot clocks going, and I'm the only one who knows what one of them is. And then, of course, after editing, those timestamps will probably be wrong anyway. Let's talk about Mubi real quick. Mubi is a streaming online cinema where, unlike Netflix, where they just dredge up anything they can get a license for, the fine
Damn.
Folks at Mubi... Well, fucking Netflix, man.
They got Luke Cage right now.
I didn't even realize that. Like, Netflix releases
things
so quickly.
I just finished the second episode.
It releases things so quickly and also lets you know about them so far in advance that I've, like, lost the ability to keep up with what's on Netflix. I no longer watch any Netflix original shows. Like, I missed the last Daredevil. I missed the last House of Cards.
My big issue is what they need to do. Even with the series like the Daredevil and Jessica Jones and stuff like that are like, I think both of those are 10 or 12 episodes, somewhere around there. They need to release them in half measures. So they just
Definitely.
Need to release like the first half of the season. And then like a week later during that weekend, release the second half, because what's right. happening right now is they release all of it at once. And there's an enormous amount of pressure to get in on the conversation. You have to
sure.
watch all of
oh, dude.
It. And it's
I
can't do that.
I didn't watch Jessica Jones, and then I didn't watch Stranger Things, because if you don't watch it that first week, it's like, well, it's going to take me maybe 2 weeks to work through this unless
sure.
I like get the flu. And at that point, yep. no one's going to be talking about it. So
yep.
I just,
especially if
just
you want to write about it.
Everybody's just already jumping into spoilers, and it's like, no, like if you would release it in like 2 weekend spurts, it would give people a chance to get in on the first kind of ground floor of the conversation.
Three days after Stranger Things hit, I saw the first memes involving some sort of tulip-headed monster.
It's bananas now.
So I was like, well, you know what? Fuck it. I don't care. And so like, I don't know anything.
Just don't say the B word, Brian. Just don't say the B word. Stranger Things. All right. You know what? No, I've already said too much about Stranger Things.
I still haven't seen Stranger Things. I don't.
Oh, okay. You're not missing anything.
All right. Well, anyway, we were talking about. Actually, you know, speaking of which, it's still super easy to get into things on HBO, and I'm super excited for Westworld tonight.
Yes.
Because
I've been binging High Maintenance. It's great.
Oh, I've heard that's good.
Wow.
Anyway.
This movie commercial really turned into something else.
Sorry, so, Mubi.
Mubi.com takes care of the issue of what binge fatigue, I guess we can call it, because they only release one film a day. You have 30 days to watch it, and during that time you can download it to your device so that you can watch it on the go even when you're not connected to Wi-Fi. Mubi is fantastic. What is out right now? Well, they are releasing Fitzcarraldo as the finale of their Herzog retrospective. And they've also got Sean Penn's film, The Crossing Guard. These are films.
Have you guys seen that? That looks pretty interesting, actually. Yeah.
No, I haven't. I'm excited to.
Yeah, it looks good.
Indeed. So those are on Mubi. You will have 30 days to watch them once they hit, and then they're gone. But every day they release another film. So once something leaves, you know it's going to be replaced by something awesome. How can you experience the joys of Mubi? You can go to Mubi, MUBI.com/filmstage, and we will give you a one month long free trial of Mubi. So go check that out. It is awesome. It's a great deal. Okay, so now that we've spent 3 minutes shitting on Netflix, let's talk about the film Camera Person. This is a new film out in limited release. It is directed by Kirsten Johnson, and it is a visual memoir / documentary that is composed of previous footage that she has shot over the course of her career.
She's been like a cinematographer on like over 40 films.
Yeah, like a crazy amount of films and documentaries. So
isn't most of it made up of footage that she didn't actually use?
I believe so.
Yes. Yeah.
That is my belief. Anyway, this will be fun. I didn't watch the trailer before queuing it up for this. I have no idea how this trailer will be cut, so I hope it's not a Tribe situation. If anyone remembers the episode on the Tribe, I clicked the trailer, and it was literally just the sound of people signing. So, fingers crossed for an auditorily interesting documentary for Camera Person.
That's pretty. Look at that yellow flower. Amazing wildflowers here.
Is the haze working for you?
Not loving it, but we're getting pieces of stuff that don't have haze.
Was it an easy delivery, that one?
Yes, it's very easy.
They caught me.
Is it okay if I film you?
All right, that is the trailer for Camera Person. Let's talk about it. Starting off with Michael Snydell, what did you think of Camera Person?
Oh God, I'm worried I'm going to be hyperbolic. It's been a few hours since I watched this, so I'm still trying to collect my thoughts. What I'd say about this is it's an extraordinarily interesting experience for someone who's, I mean, I'm not saying you have to be fluent in documentaries or anything, but I guess the best place to start is that the term cinematographer and even the role of a camera person in film as well as especially documentary gets really complicated, and it's hard to say, you know, where cinematographer ends and where a director begins. And what's so interesting about this film is it's able to make a thesis about the importance and the craft that's required in camera footage, as well as without the burden of an agenda or a narrative, it's able to just show the beauty of moments of coincidence or finding that line between intention and when something just happens perfectly. There's so many scenes in here that are I guess the best way to talk about this experience is it's kind of like channel surfing to an extent. In the sense of I don't know about you guys. I'd say we spend the average vignette is I'm going to say they're all less than 5 minutes. Would you guys agree with me?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's terrible.
Okay. All right. I guess what I want to quickly get into just in my thoughts is just that this is so great, just in how it's able to bring across so many different experiences and themes without feeling with having the knowledge of being fragmented, but still being a satisfying experience. And I think we'll get into it. The last thing I want to say is the key to this is that this is Kirsten Johnson's memoir through the images that marked her. And I think that's the key, obviously the key to how to interpret this film. So yeah, I would highly recommend this one. I'm sure it's not going to be to all tastes, but I'm definitely interested to hear what you guys think.
All right, Bill Graham, what are your basic thoughts on Camera Person?
Sure. So I think what this feels like, and Michael touched on it a little bit, I would say it's more like 30-second vignettes, especially to begin with. It feels like about 30 different origin stories, you know, like the comic book kind of terminology where you're just getting like constant flashes, constant changes of scenery, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're mixing it without labeling it. And it's really kind of disorienting at first, but I would say that about an hour in, you really kind of it settles on its own themes. I think it wasn't confident enough at the outset to really stay with any one thing because it wanted to make sure that it was going to touch on everything and then kind of settle into its own groove. So I think it definitely finds a groove kind of like an hour in, which is a shame because that seems like a lot, right?
That
you only have about 40
thirds of the movie.
Yeah, you only have about 40 minutes left. Yeah. But that it creates a unique experience. I think it's worthwhile. I think it's definitely a film that is going to be hard for a lot of audiences to really kind of embrace and get into. But that's fine. Not every movie is really made for everybody, right? And this one in particular kind of rewards the viewer for paying attention and being able to kind of spot some of the themes that are going on and things like that. There's an interesting amount of interplay between a lot of the vignettes, a lot of the things that some of the people are saying. This one in particular, a lot of it is based around religion and racial kind of wars and things like that. A lot of it is based around that, and I found it very interesting, you know, living in our present world, how relevant that is. Obviously a lot of these films, these documentaries that she's pulling footage from were within the last 20 years as well. I think most of them were actually from the 2000s or so. She's obviously a very prolific filmmaker, and I say filmmaker in a loose term. She is obviously a cinematographer.
She's directed a few films though, Bill.
Okay. Well, regardless, you know,
sure. No,
that's fine. It's interesting to see her kind of, I'm very interested to know how long it took her to make this and how much of a nightmare it was to edit, because I can just imagine there's so much footage on the ground floor that she left. But yeah, I think it's a rewarding experience when, if you can kind of get past the first kind of initial haze that it has. There's one sequence in particular that I think probably stuck with a lot of people, but a kid has a hatchet. Two young children are interacting with a hatchet, and it's fascinating to see her perspective on that, because she doesn't want to interact and she doesn't want to step in, but the whole time she verbally is hoping that nothing actually happens, you know. And sure, there's just drama there. And it's also interesting to hear her talk over the filming of footage that, you know, will probably end up, you know, taking her voice out of that footage ultimately to begin with. You know, it's like her verbalizing a lot of things, asking questions, things like that. So it's interesting to see how much she is interviewing people and asking people questions and things like that, interacting with the people in front of the camera, even though she's not necessarily the filmmaker behind most of the documentaries that she's pulling this footage from, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it?
Okay. I honestly have nothing to say about this film.
Cool. Great. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it's like as it was finished, I was like, oh, great. Shortest podcast ever. And I don't mean it to sound like I didn't like it, because I honestly have like no feelings on it. It was, you know, one of you, I can't remember who, Michael maybe said it was like flipping through channels. To me, it was more like, you know, clicking through vignettes that were stored on someone's hard drive. And, you know, there were some interesting parts. The kid with the hatchet, you know, there's a scene of a child being born that's rather, rather harrowing.
I think yeah, for the most part, I don't know. I think for the most part, the longer it goes in these little sections, the better it is. Which is why, yeah, I think it really kind of melds together towards the end, because she finally has the confidence to just let a storyline kind of ride out a little bit.
Go ahead. In the first couple things, it's like just bopping around and like,
yeah,
it's really sort of interesting, but it's not anything that's bringing me along with it. Like every time a new Chiron flashes up, I gotta recalibrate and reset to zero. And
I would agree with you. I really like the word haze. I think that was what you used, Bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, he said that.
I think haze is a really good word for that, for those opening minutes. And, you know, I definitely felt that groove where it locked in, where you guys talking about an hour through. But I think that early part is really well compiled in preparing you for what this is going to be, in the sense of, you know, you get the person with who's hurting the llamas, I believe is what those are, or you're seeing her catching a spontaneous storm, and, you know, you're jumping through all these things. And yes, it's absolutely disorienting, but you're already getting a sense of the vulnerability that's going to be present, you know, whether you're seeing a mic in the shots, or whether you're hearing her talking about the subjects. Like, these are things that we don't get in the documentary, or excuse me, in your average documentary, and probably in many of these documentaries that this footage didn't even make it into. It was, you know, contextualized in an entirely different way. And seeing it through the view of Kirsten, I think entirely changes the way these things are viewed, in the sense that it becomes less about their story, but how someone witnesses that story, which is something that's always present in a documentary, but is often buried for worry that it's going to be noise of the general narrative. But this doesn't have it doesn't have those, I don't want to say agenda, but it doesn't have those overall aims that require it to constantly push forward. And I found, and I guess I disagree with you in the sense that I found every vignette meaningful in some way, in the sense of how I could try to understand, okay, why did she pick this? Or another question is, why didn't this make it into whatever film they're talking about? And in the sense of, you know, when she feels danger about filming a prison, or you know, they are very much deleted scenes, but I don't know whether this is coming from I haven't spent a lot of time with a camera, but I've done a few projects, and I swear to God that no one ever needs to see my B-roll or C-roll ever, let alone my, you know, A-roll. But she is, by combing through, you know, 25 years of documentaries, I think she's absolutely able to find moments that wouldn't fit in any of these any of these pieces. And you know, I found every one of them interesting in what they said about her own view. And you know, there are more linear juxtapositions in the sense of, you know, you go from things like her own family and her own kids, and that stuff does get more linear. But I think even things where it jumps through, there's a point where it jumps through about stills of about 10 locations that are all locations of trauma. You know, there's things ranging from Guantanamo to Bosnian ethnic cleansing center, and it jumps through these things, and they have like a sterility that I don't know. I guess I just I found this thrilling. I guess in a way you guys did not.
Well, I think what's interesting is a lot of the locations and things like that that she ends up shooting are actually quite beautiful. And then a title card or a location card will come up and it'll tell you what that location is. And you'll be like, sure. Oh, never mind. Maybe not so beautiful. Right. And sure. It's interesting the way that those little kind of information blips will pepper your reaction to certain shots and things like that. But I think she finds a lot of humor and things like that. My main thing is I like her interacting and talking through some of the sequences more than I like some of the still image kind of stuff. I think when she's working through something with someone, I think that's when this film or this documentary, whatever you want to call it, this project really works. I think some of the more kind of mundane moments feel a little bit less. Specifically,
Phil, you give me an example of one you particularly found dull or lasting too long?
Not lasting too long necessarily, but a lot of times she, I'm trying to think of specific sequences, but there are moments where she like when she's first interacting with the nurse that's trying to give birth or trying to help birth these babies. Sure. She has this really awkward conversation with her, and I found it really weird at first. And she's trying to like drag out some information that sure. by asking some of the most kind of typical and just softball questions that she doesn't really ask anyone else. A lot of the other questions that she ends up asking a lot of other people are really kind of pointed and hard to get around kind of questions. I'm thinking of specifically when she's interacting with one of the women from Serbia, and yeah. she is completely basically saying that if you don't do any harm to anybody, no harm will be done to you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's in the face of all of this horrific madness that's gone on in Serbia with the ethnic cleansing and the mass rape of women and things like that. And she's saying, you know, we interact with Serbs and they don't do anything to us. We even have them kind of by the tail at times, and we don't do anything to them. And so that's just the way we live our lives. And it's like, yeah, and she keeps going down that route. And it's interesting because this woman just doesn't really want to kind of come to terms with what's happened in her own country. Whereas she keeps kind of throwing these softball questions at this nurse, who's really not wanting to answer any of these questions except for like one or two sentence kind of phrases. And I think that sequence in particular is really interesting, that she chose to input it into her own documentary, where she sometimes expertly navigates some of these conversations, and sometimes she just flat out isn't necessarily doing a good job. I mean, it's tough to know how much interaction she had had with that woman beforehand and things like that. And, you know, maybe she's just kind of breaking the ice with her and things like that. But some of the moments feel extraneous. Some of the moments feel a little bit unnecessary, kind of flighty things. Whereas a lot of the moments that she ends up kind of pulling into the film really have kind of a weight, and you know, just they stick with you. I don't want to talk about too many specific moments. Because I think a lot of this has to be kind of discovered on your own.
Well, I think the devil's advocate argument – well, it's not the devil's advocate. It's what I interpreted those moments where it is more dull, is that, you know, if you're a cinematographer for 25 years, you're going to get a lot of awkward moments. You're going to get a lot of boring moments here, and you get a lot of scenes that come of nothing. And, you know, that is – if this is her memoir and it's about her experiences, it's just as much about the times when things happen as – don't happen.
Sure. This is all B-roll footage, and it's like, why is it B-roll footage? Well, because a lot of the stuff was cut off for a reason, right? Was mm-hmm. cut out of whatever documentary or whatever film that she was making at the time. It was cut out for a reason, and now it's here for a different reason, right? And like you're saying, kind of part of that different reason is because she understands that being behind the camera has this kind of moment of you got to capture everything, and some of it's not going to be worth anything, but you have to have the camera rolling so when a massive piece of snow slides off the roof, you can capture that, you know? You have to have the camera rolling in those moments.
Yeah, the weird thing about it is she often forces a vulnerability. I mean, you just spoke about that snow moment, which I won't get into specifics. But, you know, she asks people to almost loop their experiences and, you know, have to repeat the same thing over or do things over that are, you know, are obviously emotional moments. Mm-hmm. And they're asked to do it again because, you know, the camera didn't get it or something. Like there's a moment where people chopping wood and she didn't catch the main thing that they said. And it's just a whole conversation about how she didn't catch what she was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, come on. I want to get something out of it. Do you not have like any takes on any feelings about any of this stuff?
No, I don't. Like, I got nothing to offer you. Like, I was in despair after this movie was over, because I was like, what even are we going to talk about? Like, what is there to say? Like, I don't... No? No. N-O. Not I don't know. I don't... .. N-O. Like, there's... I have nothing to critique. I have nothing to add. This is very clearly what it wants to be. Good.
You said you were, or maybe I'm mistaken, but didn't you have a journalism background, Brian?
Yeah.
So did you have to do some video work for classes or anything like that?
Yep.
I mean, what has been your experience with did you have any personal, so you didn't have any personal connection to, you know, your own experiences with B-roll? Or Bill, this goes along with you. I'm not trying to take you out. I'm not trying to bring, this makes it sound narcissistic, but I was definitely thinking about my own experiences with this, and like, I'm annoyed that she caught those things that I wish I caught.
I don't know what she's catching that I haven't caught previously. Like this isn't a film that makes me feel any more strongly about the form of documentary filmmaking. It's pretty obvious why a lot of this stuff was left out, because it's stilted and awkward, and none of it is breaking any new ground visually. I mean, like, you know, I did a lot of video journalism in college and then beyond that for fun.
Sure.
And end of story? Like, I guess maybe it's a problem that I did do it, because none of this is revelatory or interesting to me. It's not. I didn't feel like I was being taken on a personal journey, which, if it's not the point, then that's fine. But I tend to watch films for emotional or narrative revelations and to feel something, or just to generally be entertained by bright lights and noises. And this, like I said, it was, you know, like I remember when my grandfather died, my grandmother wanted to throw out everything that was in the attic, and I went through it and I found a number of news clippings and his old patrol logs from when he was a New York cop, and like birth papers from when he was on a ship, not being born, but having a birth on a ship. And like, a lot of this stuff was super interesting. And then there was a lot of stuff that was like a receipt from a hardware store or a single nail. And this movie feels like a receipt from a hardware store and a single nail. It's not meaningless and it's not bad, but I've got nothing to gain from seeing it, and it in no way changes my perception of the subject itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the course of watching it, I felt nothing and was changed in no way and took nothing from it. And it is possible that had I not watched this, I would have binged watched a previous season of New Girl, or continued my rewatch of The Wire, or perhaps taken a nap or read a book or anything. And I don't believe that in any way the course of my life or my thoughts for the day would have changed. So that is my very long way of saying I understand that people have gotten things from this movie. Jordan Raup, our illustrious editor and chief, was very excited about this film. And I know he listens to these, so I apologize in advance that I am super boring this episode, but I can't for the life of me think of anything controversial were interesting to say in relation to this movie. And I'm not, I don't want to be, I'm not being mean. You know, guys, I can be mean to a movie I don't like. You know, go back and listen to Kate Plays Christine if you want to hear some of that Rowan fury that's a part of my brand. I will say that, you know, I don't trust people who like such and such a movie. go listen to Queen of Earth if you want to hear that. This is not that. This is... I'm glad that you got something from it. I did not. And that's it. It's like, you know, some guys are into cars. Some guys grow up, they like trains. Some guys want to ride bulls for a living. Some people watch Camera Person and get something out of it. And I don't...
And some people just want to see the world burn.
Yeah, I mean, like, even, you know, but again, that's another thing. I don't get it, but I'm not about to take it away from you if you like it.
Sure.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I don't have... I wish I'd hated it. I wish I'd loved it, you know, but I'm watching it, and it's like there's care and craft that went into this, but it's not working on me, so I can't add anything to this in a productive or meaningful way. It's...
Well, okay. Well,
I feel like I let you down. Like, I really...
No, you did. You didn't let me down. I'm just I'm trying to find a way to continue this conversation. Because,
well, I mean, you guys liked it. Like, are you done saying what you liked about it? Like, that's one of my problems with documentaries often, and why we don't talk about them a lot on this podcast is, unless there's something like the... What is that? The Imposter, you know,
sure,
where there's some formal nonsense as well as a compelling story. There's not a lot to talk about from a standpoint of someone who primarily does fiction films. I can't really say, you know, documentary is a difficult thing to do. And when it is executed correctly, it can be a transcendent experience. But...
Whoa! You just said this wasn't executed correctly.
I didn't say this was executed correctly. I said documentary, as a formal genre, when executed correctly, can be a transcendent experience. And but it's difficult to talk about because it deals with life. And so the basic, like, you know, when we talk about a fiction film, we often talk about the writing and the camera choices and the editing, and we can still talk about those a little bit in a documentary, but we can't throw shade on Damon Lindelof and Ridley Scott when documentary fails to engage us, because sometimes it's just in God's hands what happens, and it becomes difficult to, you know, really get into it in that way. It either affects you or doesn't. I don't know.
I mean, that's not necessarily true. I mean, I think you can, I think you can absolutely say that Kirsten Johnson did not succeed as a vision. I don't think documentary should, just because it's some reflection of some experience through a specific perspective. I mean, I think you can absolutely, I don't know. I find the way that you're describing documentary strangely anonymous. Is this the word I'm looking for? I don't know.
Anonymous might work if I'm obscuring my own identity in order to... No, I don't think anonymous works.
Yeah, that's not the word I'm looking for.
Antiseptic?
Well, I think what Brian's kind of hinting at, and I agree with him for the most part, is that a lot of times documentaries, unless they are particularly they hit home for you as a person. Now, not every single documentary is going to hit home for every person, right? But I think if you connect to it, there is usually a personal connection that you can kind of pull out and extrapolate and kind of it's a classic. What did the author mean versus what can you extrapolate out of it? And I think documentary is one of those key ones when it's a film like this that is so personal. This one is very personal. And so if you're not connecting to it, there isn't a whole lot else to really pull out of this. This isn't, you know, some big kind of narrative film or documentary where it has some kind of revelation and some kind of big situation that it's kind of describing or showing. This is just
Is it not?
In small snippets, and I think that's where Brian mainly has an issue, is that there's such small snippets that they never really add up to anything for him.
Right.
Now,
just to put a button on what you said, Bill, I would love to see any of the movies that are excerpted in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. And so I think that's part of it, is the way that she's framed this is hard for some people to kind of get into, because again, I think really the film opens up kind of an hour in, and by that time it's almost a little too late for some people. They've already kind of checked out.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the fault of the filmmaker, but it's also kind of the fault of the medium itself. I'm curious if she had anyone else watch this, you know, if she was the only editor on the film. And I could look that up on IMDb, but I don't really care.
There was definitely an editor in the end credits.
So, you know, I wonder what that kind of interplay was like for her to basically say, this is what I want my film to be. And for an editor to be like, okay, I'll give that to you, you know? And so I'm curious what that conversation was like.
Would you guys be interested in that conversation if this was also a film about how she decided how she would compile her life?
Wait,
I know that's
what
I think that would have to be completely different. But I mean, if I saw a five or 10, 15 minute vignette kind of about her. You know, I mean, that could have been something she added in the end credits. That would have been interesting to kind of have that conversation going on during the end credits. But no, I think either you're going to enjoy this or you're not. I don't think there's a whole lot of kind of middle ground. This is definitely going to be one of those films that just people either kind of gravitate to and appreciate, or they just are like, I don't. What was that, you know?
Again, guys, I've only reviewed like one doc with you guys previously, so I'm still just, you know, trying to figure out how you guys Kate Plays Christine. I'm gonna say that's a doc for the sake of our conversation.
Okay. Have fun with that.
Anyways, I think
you're such an ass, Brian.
There's no way that that's a goddamn documentary.
Damn it. Did we have to talk about
it? No. Never mind. Nope.
All right, whatever.
Okay. Anyways, I don't know. I mean, this one doesn't particularly lend itself to a lot of conversation if you didn't connect to it. And so I think there are some moments in there that are certainly, you know, interesting to watch and kind of see her go about her life. But I don't know, this is definitely a personal journey film. This isn't something that's some kind of big narrative or anything like that.
That's totally fair, but I didn't mean to make it sound like I was disagreeing on that sense.
No, that's fine. You enjoyed this. You really liked this, and
that's great.
That's fine. But you know, it's not really a film for everybody. And you know, as Brian can kind of attest to.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't know.
Are we done?
I guess so.
If you guys have things to talk about, like, I can basically hand the reins over to you, because I can't even do that thing I sometimes do where I just come up with something and toss it out there for people who liked a film or didn't like a film to fight over. I don't want to say a complete non-entity to me, but the deeper aspects of it that you have been praising for the last half an hour or so are lost on me completely. And I can't. Mm. It's like if I was trying to lead a discussion of a book without having read the book. You know, it's like, well, what did you,
did you think it had
second act problems?
Yeah. No. I understand that. Yeah. No, that's fine. I think some of the bigger aspects of this film in particular, like I mentioned, were kind of the religious aspects and kind of the racial wars. And I guess a lot of documentaries are made on controversial topics and things like that. That's why they ultimately end up as documentaries and not necessarily as films, because otherwise, if they had something really interesting narratively, they would probably try to sell it as a movie. Something like The Imposter kind of blends those two genres together, right? It's doing recreation while also doing investigation. And a lot of people kind of criticize that film for being kind of a high budget, those network kind of shows,
testimonial type thing.
No, there's a genre of them on like CBS, like late night Sundays,
like
where
true
they,
crime?
Yeah, true crime.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, a lot of people kind of Dateline stuff and you know, getting away with
America's
murders.
Most Wanted.
Yeah, stuff like that, where they just kind of recreate and they kind of go through and they kind of tell you about the story and they make it really compelling and everything like that. But I found Imposter to be much more interesting in that it either was or wasn't actually using the main character that is kind of a scumbag as the recreator of the fake film or fake footage. And it's like that whole film is just an entanglement of a mess in like how you're not really supposed to get that close to your subject if you're also trying to put that subject on a skewer, right? It's an interesting way. It, just like how A Look of Silence is the same way, and what was the previous film?
Act of Killing.
Yeah, the Act of Killing was also in that way, in that vein.
Sure.
This one, I don't know. This is just, it's such a
abstract experience.
Yeah, it is, and yet, like I said, I think her confidence builds towards the end where it starts to become cohesive in what she's trying to say from point to point. And you start to realize why she's flashing from point to point in the way that she's doing it. Whereas at first it is literally 30 seconds of here's a setting, here's some people talking, or here's some sheep being moved around. And it's like, what are you doing? I don't understand it. And like I said, it towards the end, it really kind of gels. And I think her confidence kind of as a filmmaker, trying to tell a narrative works better towards the end. So yeah, that was kind of my overall thoughts on it, I guess.
No, that's totally fair.
This is the most sedate podcast I think that we've ever had. And I have done this podcast extremely hungover before.
Yep.
Yeah, there's, you know.
I think that's just ultimately what ends up happening with a lot of these kind of personal journey documentaries.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, it's a personal story, and I can't, you know, like I said, I can't say, well, I thought this movie was bullshit, because it's not. This is real life, this is what happened, and this is how it was chosen to be presented, and I don't feel any need to belittle that and say that it didn't work for me.
There is a moment that I found really interesting when she was, I guess, on Guantanamo or in Guantanamo Bay, and she was basically told that she had to destroy some footage, and the way that she destroyed it was literally filming a table with some like microphones on top of it, just like a static shot. And I was that moment was really curious to me because I mean, what was she filming that on that she had to film over it to erase it? What kind of, I mean, it had to be like what, like a DV or something like that? Or was it actual film? I mean, it more than likely it wasn't actual film, but maybe it was like a handheld camera or something like that, where it was filmed on like a tape or something like that. But I thought it was interesting that she wasn't literally erasing it. She was just writing over whatever it was. And I guess maybe she was going to hand that back over for them to like reclassify and then declassify and be like, yep, okay, that works. And it's like,
yeah,
what if she switched the tapes, or what if she did, you know, something like that? And it's like, man, that seems like such a low tech way and such a weird way of being like, hey, you shouldn't have filmed that. I'm going to have you film a static shot for 2 minutes over that. It's like, what? Really? That's what you want me to do? I guess. I don't know.
I mean,
interesting moment for me.
Yeah, no, I really like those moments because they're just stuff you don't see, and you know, for like a bit of professional,
you know, the documentary.
Docs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or,
sure.
You know.
The finished version of them. Yeah, you don't see that kind of stuff. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Any final thoughts on camera person?
I'm wondering, do either of you guys, KPC is not, KPC Christine is not a great example, but I'm thinking of it nonetheless because it's a film that's a lot about process. This is a lot about process. I'm making false equivalencies here, but Brett, do you generally dislike films that are about process?
That's a crazy question because almost every film is about process.
Yeah, you're right.
Like,
I guess formal
Ocean's
process about,
is about
the creation.
Process.
That is constantly...
Here's a better question.
I'd like Michael to try to hone his.
Okay.
Sorry.
You're really like, fumble with words, aren't you? Cool.
How about do you watch behind the scenes footage and things like that?
Oh, hell yeah.
That's better.
I buy Criterions like crazy so that I can watch the behind the scenes documentaries. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Same here. Yeah.
For
some of my favorite films, if I can get, I mean, honestly, if you gave me a bad film and then gave me the option of like rewatching it, or let me rephrase that.
AV Club used to do commentary tracks of The Damned. Did you ever read that?
No.
That's not. Oh. Yeah.
It was like they'd find shit movies and then they would listen to the commentary track.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't that Raven?
I think it might have been, yeah. And
that to me, like, I would much rather experience a bad film from behind the scenes than I would actually watching it. Like that to me, that whole process to me is much more interesting to maybe see what was going on, because I remember a lot of the documentary when the extended cuts of the Hobbit films came out. They did like a big like Blu-ray release of like all three of them, and they were all the extended cuts, and they had like this giant making of documentary. And a lot of people, when they were watching it, and obviously this was early press when it kind of broke out, because they were given review copies and things like that, and they were just digging into the behind the scenes stuff, and they said that it became very apparent how frantic and crazy it was on set, and how little stuff they had And they just basically said it became very obvious why Peter Jackson didn't make the same kind of hit that the original Lord of the Rings trilogy was, because he was just doing so much with so little as far as material and things like that, you know.
I mean, one of my favorite David Mamet films is State in Maine, which is all about trying to get a movie made.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, okay,
that's a process. I don't know. I looked it up. Commentary Tracks of the Damned was a recurring feature that had many, many, many different writers work on it.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. But I mean, it sounds like a Raven thing, doesn't it?
Okay. It does, yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Camera person, not for me. Maybe you'll like it.
I guess this is kind of almost a behind-the-scenes collection of 100 different documentaries.
Yeah.
Like 5 minutes, 5 minute bits.
Yeah.
I found it a lot more meaningful about that, but that's not technically wrong.
I mean, if I could say one really, truly, unabashedly great thing about this, it has made me interested in all of the films that were featured, and I may look them up.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
there is that. This will help with my blind spot for documentaries. Well, this is going to be the first podcast in forever that is less than an hour long. So, unless we want to vamp for another 6 minutes.
Nope.
Okay, cool. So that's it for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Michael, you going to be okay?
I am going to cry myself to sleep tonight.
Watch Westworld. That'll help you out.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Nah.
All right. Never mind. Don't watch Westworld. That's one of those metatextual shows that's like about making shows, right? So that also counts as a thing about process.
I don't know about that. All right. Let's.
All right. So find us on iTunes. Give us a comment. Give us a rating. We're usually a lot more incendiary than we were today. I promise that soon we will have another shouting match on this show. In the meantime, you can follow us on the Twitter and the Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. And let me remind everyone at home that you can have a free 30-day trial of MUBI by going to mubi.com/filmstage. MUBI, the curated online cinema that we all love, and that I was actually going to say probably has at some point featured many of the documentaries that were shown in this movie. Because MUBI seeks out stuff that is both intellectually and socially engaging. So maybe we can keep an eye out and let people know as those things pop up online. That's MUBI, MUBI.com/filmstage for your 30-day trial. Okay, guys, let's tell the fine people where we can be found between now and the next time we speak. Let's start with Bill Graham.
You can find me watching a documentary on my birthday. You can also find me on Twitter at CableBFG. No, but 2 weeks will be. And that's a spoiler alert for anyone that's going to my birthday, because it's technically a mystery movie. Hey, still haven't named it though, by the way. But
I didn't get my invite, Bill.
Yeah, what the shit, yeah. Bill?
I'll put it on Facebook Live for sure. I'm sure the Alamo Draft House will have no issue with that, considering it's my screening during my movie. So meh. But yeah. And you can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv.
All right. Michael Snydell.
You can find me taking B-roll of things that nobody wants to see on Twitter at Snydell. And I will be writing some things from the Chicago International Film Festival, which takes place over the next 3 weeks. And
how do you say that? Do they say it? Do they call it SIFF?
They do call it SIFF. Yes.
SIFF. Huh. Interesting.
Isn't that the warrior woman from the Thor movies?
It is.
Wow.
Jamie Alexander, I believe.
Currently starring on Blindspot on NBC.
Yes. Tattooed from head to toe.
All right.
We have really run out of things to talk about today. I'm Brian Rowan. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me everywhere else at Brian J. Rowan. Find me writing at the film stage. We will have an interview, actually, with the composer for The Vessel, which I talked about a little while ago, who's also the composer for Knight of Cups, To the Wonder, and Voyage of Time. So check that out. That'll be up soon. I just have to edit out like the 30 minutes we spent talking about beekeeping, if you can believe it. That is not a joke. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
I would read that, Brian. That sounds like good B-roll.
Perfect B-roll for my upcoming documentary podcast person. Anyway, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and join us next week on the Film Stage Show. That's why.